imagination.
I picked up on Romans. And where it starts off saying, therefore you are without defense, mm-hmm. O gentle man, every one of you who passes judgment, for in the judgment you pass on to someone else, you condemn yourself. Well, when I was reading that, that first line is what really caught my eye, therefore you without defense. And I saw that as you're leaving yourself without the protection of God, mm-hmm. or you're choosing to leave yourself without the protection of God or the Torah. And and everything that God has to offer you, like loving kindness and mercy and patience, and somebody that chooses idolatry or self-seeking ambition, anything like that, I had this thing in my head where I saw a scale or that has the double scale that they used to use, and I just saw one tipping further,
very good,
heavier than the other, and
very good.
I was just thinking, a judgment day, that don't look too good for you.
Okay, very good, very good. We'll speak some more about that to Dr. Taylor.
I had the same thing that she does, that we need to realize and recognize that, you know, that what we are and what we have and what we do are the callings of God, and, you know, we need to keep that scale balanced to the positive on us, at least middle way, but to the positive on our side if possible.
Amen. Amen. Words of Hollow.
Romans, as far as the Nazarene code is still for me too, but I guess I'm looking at it not quite like they are. It's, for me, the battle always seems to be our mind and our mouth, does it not? So,
with, I don't know, does it?
It does. It always seems to come down to that for me. And everything that we say or do begins as a battle in the mind. Everything starts in the head. But for me, the question is regarding this. When you're passing judgment, I know you're not supposed to pass judgment on people, but we need to find again, correct me if I'm wrong, there has to be a balance, because you have to pass some judgment on the fruits. Like, clearly, I'm not going to hang out with there's certain characters they're not going to be what I hang out with. So we have to have some judgment in balance. Am I not correct?
Well, you're not making a judgment. You're basically assessing a personality or something like that. But that's you're not passing judgment on somebody.
So could judgment in this case, for my mind, be a you're talking about a sentence, like if someone's going to get a positive or a negative.
Yeah, this is in the form of him making a judgment against people, then he has no right or authority to make this judgment, as we'll see.
Okay, and then I also noticed this, that Gentile was, is that an added word?
Okay. For clarity, absolutely.
So this isn't just talking about Gentile, this is talking about people in general.
No, it's Gentile specifically, a Gentile man, a single man is passing judgment. This is the difficulty with the case. A single judge cannot judge. This is not a Jewish judgment, and it's an illegitimate judgment because you have to have a Beit Din. So someone who sits and judges, even in the way our judicial system functions today, it is not appropriate because you need a Beit Din of 3 Hakamim to sit on the Beit Din in order to have a judgment. So
okay.
Here you have a single man making judgment.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes, thank you.
Very good. You're at Ruth?
Yeah. Actually, if you don't mind, what's the difference between judgment and assessment?
Well, when you're passing a judgment on somebody, in the sense of the way that we'd use it in the biblical phrase, is that someone is going to have to pay a penalty for whatever the judgment is. But if you're assessing someone's personality, you're looking at their personality and say, that person, I don't care to be around that person because he has these characteristics, etc. Doesn't mean that you're actually going to be the one who judges him, and then he gets punished because of what you think about him.
So, the distinction you're making is discernment.
Yeah, you discern or you assess his character or whatever, but you don't. You're not there to say this guy needs to be punished, and I'm going to be the judge, and this is the sentence I place on this person, etc.
It's a court decision. It's like set in the context of a court, rather than just a personal opinion about something.
Yeah, and this guy's doing it as if he were the chief cook and bottle washer, or the chief whatever he is. Okay, very good. Rolling you well.
I enjoyed just looking at the court situation. They would judge on Mondays and Thursdays.
Mm-hmm.
And how that lines up with Yeshua's death. Mm-hmm. And who it was that we're trying to put him to death.
Absolutely.
So the whole thing about judgment and legitimate or illegitimate courts is very interesting.
Very good. That's where we'll try to bring some illumination this evening. Okay? You all ready?
Me?
Joshua?
Yes, actually. I found it interesting that they could not understand him, yet they feared. The Talmudim did not understand Yeshua, but they feared his words all the same. And I was wondering that when he was speaking to them at this time, he wasn't speaking to them directly, but was preparing their spirits, because when somebody dies suddenly, it's a shock. And more than the physical body, and he was preparing their spirits for the fact that he was about to go, and that he's about to be taken from them, so that the spirit could strive on through the grief, because the spirit already knew it was coming.
Right.
But if they had known physically in the way that we, I don't know how to say it, but in the way that we know things, then they would have done something to stop it. They would have put forth some sort of force to try to stop it, and that was not required at that time.
Yeah, well, you look at Hakam Safet, in places, he does that. He stands up and says to Yeshua, no, this is not going to happen. In essence, he's saying, I'm not going to let it happen. So you understand that they did look at things very much from the natural, if you will, but he's trying to show them that not only is he going to die, but he's going to be resurrected. But now this is a tremendous difficulty in the mind of his disciples, his Talmudim, because they've never seen anybody die and get resurrected. Oh, we brought somebody back from the dead, raised them from the dead, but guess what? After a while,
it's different, and it's also different than coming back on your own.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. Not so much on your own, but by the hand of God, rather than by an intermediary or an agent, right?
That's exactly what I
thought. That's what I just had to do a little interpretation. But all right.
I found it so interesting, the Romans 13:1-10, and where it says, let every Gentile soul be subject to the governing authorities of the Jewish synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
I found that so interesting because for so many years we've heard in the churches, in the modern day churches, that the governing authorities are the laws of the land which we are supposed to be following.
We're going to address that very subject this evening.
And I found that so interesting.
Very good. You hit it right, the nail right on the head. Right on the head. Very good.
I think that translation, we should all go on a campaign and post it all over the web. That is a world-changing scenario there.
Very much so.
It
goes back to that Bible agenda thing.
Very good. Don Zeb, you have something you want to chime in with, or you want to come back later?
Well, did. Let me see if I can find it.
You got 3 seconds. 3, 2,
17.
This is something I've thought about from time to time, and it's interesting to come back to it. Again, it's sort of like a reversal, what he said, because most people, depending on their background, many people, majority of people in the Western world will read Colossians 2:16, let no one judge you, and
right.
This and that and the other, and it gets convoluted into, don't be a legalist, don't worry about Sabbaths and moons and all this stuff, and it's just interesting to, again, come back to the place of the fact that the reality was that he was encouraging the ones who were converting or on steps of conversion,
right,
to say, hey, if your friends give you a hard time because you didn't make it to the Feast of Jupiter, don't worry about it, and or that's just, that's going to be part of the issue
right.
From now on. If you're really going to go this way, you could potentially have to endure some...
And they did.
Some difficulties.
They absolutely did, of course. Now, one thing that I don't know if you have heard me talk about how this translation comes about. If you look at this verse in your typical Bible or King James, New Kingdom, whatever you use, you'll notice that the way that the verse is stated, that it looks as if what we did is jumble verse 17, 16 and 17. But you have to keep in mind, in the Greek text, many times what you find is that the verse is paragraph and a half long. And so somewhere in here you need to make a logical sentence out of something. But because it is an entire verse, single verse, Greek does not follow the dramatic rules of
English,
absolutely, and Hebrew for that matter. So sometimes what you find is that when the... when you write in Greek, you put the most important words at the beginning. And then, if you start to read through it, and if you look at a typical Greek interlinear, you'll look at it and have all the words numbered. And say, this is number one, this is number two, this is number three, etc. But when you read it, it's all jumbled up and the order is confused. But of course, then you have someone saying, this word should be number one, two, three, etc. And that isn't always necessarily so. So what happens is, when you look at this verse and you look at the way it's translated, translated with a combination of what appears to be verse 16 and 17 and then putting the words in their proper order. So we'll talk more about that in a minute. Here, Hadassah, I know it's short notice. Do you have something you want to...
Not at this time, actually.
Okay.
Let's come back to me later.
Okay, we'll ask you later.
My thoughts sorted out.
Very good. Okay. One thing that I want you to do is, if you will go with me to page 45 at the bottom of the page. Well, let's go to the top of the page first. I bought a book many years ago, and the book had an illustration on the front of the book, and the name of the book was, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand? by the late Vendell Jones of blessed memory. It had a picture of Yeshua, or let's say it this way, it had three pictures on the front. One was a long-haired, blue-eyed Catholic, and then another guy was, you know, another scenario, and then they had one that looked very Jewish with a kippah and etc. Then you flip the cover open, and inside the cover, he posited a warning and said, if you have any sacred bulls in your mental corral, you might want to be careful here because we're going to do some sacrifices. And so,
at least 70.
Yeah, exactly. And so, that being said, at the top of the page where it says commentary to Hakam Safed's School of Peshat, Yeshua says here that he's handed over to the Gentiles, specifically to the Romans. And then you should know that when we talk about things in prophecy, we talk about Rome. And Rome has several titles. Okay, and so those are some rudimentary titles. And now when we say Rome, we're not speaking generally about Rome of antiquity. We're speaking about Rome of antiquity, but Rome, even to this day, so Rome is a symbol for Christianity. Now, I'm not here to get excited and start criticizing every Christian, but there will be some things that we say this evening that might be difficult to explain otherwise, so we need to understand as we move through the explanation that we're not trying to be their critic, but there's things that we've accepted and followed in the past that are constantly being challenged and constantly being changed. Now, one of the things that is part of the materials as you look at what's going on and you go down to the bottom of the page where it says the Beit Din Gadol could not assemble to condemn Yeshua, this is simply stated in the Mishnah. Mishnah Ketubot 1:1, a virgin that marries on Wednesday and a widow on Thursday, for twice weekly, this is telling you about the courts. It's not just that they're only there to handle marital cases. They're there to handle cases on those two particular days. Actually, they'll also be there on Monday, but for twice weekly were the courts in session on Mondays and Thursdays, as I said. So if the husband had a complaint as to virginity, etc., it would go to the court. Okay. Now, we can elaborate further, but I'm just going to paraphrase and sum up a little bit. Yeshua's death, some are concerned about the Lishkat Hagaseit, the chamber of the hewn stone, and saying that the Sanhedrin Gadol couldn't meet in the chamber of the hewn stone, and because they couldn't meet in the chamber of the hewn stone, then they couldn't pass a death penalty. Well, the difficulty is that much of what went on in the Sanhedrin was still in much under the control of the Romans already. So there was a little bit of difficulty to make just any death sentence happen from a Sanhedrin perspective. It would definitely have to be the Sanhedrin Gadol, etc., in order to make the death penalty stick. And then there was only certain things that the death penalty could be pronounced for. Now, never would a Sanhedrin sit where it was on the approach of a festival to where that they were concerned that perhaps a capital case might take place and that it might take a couple days. So if a capital case would take place and it was going to take more than a couple days, then it usually was pushed away from a Thursday and moved more toward a Monday, okay, which is very much what you see in the idea of having a court on Monday. Now, the Sadducees carry Yeshua to the Roman leader and trump up some charges of sedition and whatnot, so that they, when he comes before Pilate, they're seeing that, you know, he's coming against Rome, the plot of Rome, the thought, the theme of Rome, etc. And so this is the only way that they can make these things stick. Now, as we said before, you need to understand that the Sadducees and the Pharisees did not keep Passover on the same day. So the Sadducees kept Passover a day early, and the Pharisees kept the Passover a day later than they did. They kept it how we keep it today. Should raise a question. The question is,
Ma. Well, why?
Why what?
Why did they do it differently?
Because they were Sadducees and Pharisees.
No, there's more to it than that.
This is the interpretation of how and when the day starts and which day was being in question. Whether you start the 14th or you end the 14th.
Weren't the earliest records?
Huh?
What are the earliest records? Weren't there records they could go by?
They could go by the oral Torah, but the Sadducees wouldn't listen to the oral Torah.
So then that's why we go with Pharisees.
Yeah, because the Pharisees did it correctly. But the Sadducees did it a day early, and the Pharisees did it on the correct day, and now that should strike a question.
How come Yeshua did it on the day of the Sadducees?
Exactly.
Because he knew he was going to die the next day. We're not dead. Yeah.
He said he wanted to eat the Passover Seder before he suffered. So he did it because he wanted to celebrate that festival before everything went down. That's why he did it when he did it.
Okay, how can that possibly be? So he's validating the Sadducees and the way they kept the Pesach, or... What, we don't do it that way now, or we should do it that way now, or what?
Is it because there was a Beit Din ruling, whether or not it was a Sanhedrin or Sanhedrin Gadol, but because there was a Beit Din ruling that allowed it, he could, then I have no clue.
Okay, nope. If Yeshua did this, then, but we don't do this now, so is it because he was...
We can say that in general terms, but you have to be very careful because he does not 100% fit into the qualifications of being a Pesach offering.
Then if he doesn't 100% fit into the qualifications, then how can he can be considered to be the be it all?
He's a little of this, he's a little of that, a little of this, and a little of that. But 100%, none. But, and there's much more to be said about that, but that's not the case. The point here is, and what Yeshua is doing, is he's doing a sin for the sake of heaven. Okay? He's doing something for the sake of tikkun, and he's becoming, as it were, a Pesach sacrifice, or he's showing you the true purpose of the Pesach sacrifice, and he's trying to bring a particular tikkun about by his personal death and resurrection, etc. Okay, so it specifically relates to redemption. Not wholly and strictly redemption through him, but redemption by and large. Okay? So, understanding that, number one, that the Sadducees could not bring about the death sentence in and of themselves. They needed Yeshua, they needed the Pharisees, and they needed the Sanhedrin Gadol to make this happen, which they did not make.
Sorry,
it.
Rabbi. But the redemption that we're discussing is not, we're not talking about a national redemption per se. We're talking about some specific tikkunim.
Messiah is too complex of a subject to narrow down into something that you can say, this is the end all, be all.
Right. So,
understanding that. There are many personifications of Messiah through history, right? And each one in each generation is offering a particular tikkun in each particular generation.
Right.
So,
that's actually my point.
Moshe is, in some sense, a picture of Messiah. David is a picture of Messiah, et cetera, right? So, you have these personifications, and throughout history, these things are addressed. It's interesting because not only is it Messiah, but it's the Jewish people and the Tzadikim, the righteous people, etc., that are making these reparations, etc. Okay? Okay, now let's go to Romans, and we will stick our neck on the chopping block.
We'll come back to it in the end. How about that?
Yeah, it's good. Page 44. You are without defense, O Gentile, and as Givrit the Zahava noted, Gentiles implied. And here, everything Givrit Zahava is in singular.
Okay.
So we're not talking about you Gentiles, plural. And you guys that do judges, here it's in the singular, showing us that it is one individual who is doing this judgment, etc. Okay? So, this individual, as we said, is passing judgment. And then you come to the place here that you can see that there's judgment taking place. And the judgment that's taking place is an illegal judgment. Very much the same, and I guess I could be hauled away for sedition by saying this, I guess, but our judicial system is everything but the true judicial system ordained by God, right? So we got one man stands up there and said, you're guilty, and et cetera, et cetera. And he makes the decision. That's not the way it's done in a Beit Din of three men who weigh out the circumstances, etc. The material that you will have this evening for Sabbath beginning tomorrow evening will deal in some length with legalities and the law, the Torah, etc. And believe me, what we did in the 9-page commentary only touched the tip of the iceberg. And so I tried to be much more concise than that, but hopefully it'll be something that will be inspiring. Okay, so we come here to the understanding that the court has to be a Beit Din, and it's a Jewish Beit Din. Now, I know. If there were tomatoes, and I said this in the Christian church, it wouldn't be tomatoes. It'd be, we got a rope and there's a tree outside, and
they might bring stoning back in.
They might do this.
They might make an exception.
There's a considerable difficulty when we come to think about the fact that the Jewish people. Number one are the chosen people of God, and guess what? They didn't say, hey, We're the ones, pick us. He's the one who picked them and said, you'll be my chosen generation, my chosen people, my priests, my kings, etc. So the choosing and election for all these things took place at, by God himself. The Jewish people didn't say, hey, you know, we think we'd like to be the special ones. And if you remember from Fiddler on the Roof, he said, you know, why did we have to be so chosen? You know, it's could be.
Once in a while, can't you choose someone else?
Yeah, it's because it's pretty tough when we stop to think about all these things and the way that the Jewish people have had to pay for being kings and priests to the Gentiles. And it's, as we said a little bit in the past, what transpires in the time of Yeshua, in the time of Hakam Shaul and Hakam Tzafet, is that the Gentiles are coming to or turning to God, and their turning to God means that they have to come to the Jewish people. Go to Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9, verse 4. Who are the Israelites? To whom pertain the adoption? Okay, so they're the ones that receive the adoption, the glory, the kibbutz. We talk about this a little bit, the covenants, the giving of the Torah, the service of God, and the promises. Okay, so note the things that have been given to them. So, for example, here, if you want to understand the Torah, where do you go? Who got it? To the Jews. Okay, keep your finger here. Go to Romans 1. Verse 16. Romans 1:16. For I'm not ashamed of the Masorah of Messiah, for it is the power, this is the virtuous power of God to salvation. We'll talk about that in a minute. For everyone who is faithful, and it is not to the Jew, it's by the Jew first. Okay? So you need to understand that it's not the Jews that are receiving the Masorah, it's the Jews who are giving the Masorah. And then he says also, by the Hellenists, the Hellenistic Jews. Go back to Romans 9. So, if you want to talk to someone who knows the law, you have to talk to those who received the law. Then, it says here, the service of God. Go into the first congregation that you choose on Sunday morning, say, wait, this is not right. Look at here, it says, we have the service of God, now let me show you how the service goes. And probably be either stoning or a rope hanging outside for you.
When I get directed to some Christians who really try, really, really, even with the kadosh.
Now let's go to, let's do it on your notes on page.
Your liturgy is very close.
So
well,
close.
So close
and yet
so close.
Very nice.
How close are the camps and horseshoes and hibernates?
So does that mean
their incense sure does smell good.
Well, one of the things I've said is that the closest thing to Judaism is Catholicism.
And I would also argue for Eastern Orthodox Christianity.
Okay, but we can also say that the thing that's the farthest from Judaism is Catholicism. Why? Because it's like looking at the dial. It has to go all the way around the other side to get to the correct, okay?
And Eastern Orthodox Christianity.
Exactly. So they fit up there right pretty close to one another, okay? So now let's go to page 48, and then I want to begin to deal with a couple of things. He says, and this is our translation. When I made this translation and had it in a commentary some time ago, His Eminence was a little bit puzzled because I connected some pieces that I had heard tidbits from, so I put it all together. So let's just try to read some of this and then we'll see how it goes. Let every Gentile soul be subject to the governing authorities of the Jewish synagogue, for there is no legitimate authority except that of the Jewish Beit Din from God, and the authorities of the Beit Din that exist are appointed by God. Now, what we said in Romans 9 about the services and the Torah applies not only to the written Torah, but to the oral Torah as well. And so many things are in the oral Torah that are not in the written Torah to elucidate how these things are to function. So these are the authorities that have been appointed by God. And therefore we have to realize that system that is established by God is a system that is one that shows the true clarity of how a system is supposed to work. Now, let me just make some statements so we can figure this out. I have to do it this way. I'm reading from Derek Hashim. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this book. On page 95, said this is by Luzzatto. Luzzatto, many thought that he was a Kabbalist. He definitely was a Kabbalist. Derek Hashim is not a Kabbalistic work. It's more a Midrashic work. Why? You'll find out as you listen, if you are kingdom-minded. So we have stated earlier that the purpose of creation of human species is that man should become worthy of attaining true good, namely to be drawn close to him, to God, in the world to come. Hence, the ultimate end of all his involvements is tranquility in the world to come. Now let me make a quick detour. Romans 11. I'm going to give you a little hermeneutic exercise here. 11:26. Hakam Shul says, "And all Israel will be saved, as it is written, the Deliverer will come out of Zion, and he will turn away all ungodliness from Yahweh. For this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins." Okay? Now listen to this particular writing. It says, "And all Israel will have their portion in the world to come. As it is said, all your people will be righteous. They will inherit the land forever, the branch of my planting and the work of my hands, that I may be glorified." It's the same exact passage from Isaiah that's being read, and it gives you a hermeneutic principle. Okay? Hacham Shaul said, "For all Israel will be saved." Note saved. And then note what we just read from Perkei Avot. It says all of Israel will merit the Olam Haba. So what is salvation?
Meriting
the Olam Haba. Okay. So if you're saved, that means you merit the Olam Haba. If you merit the Olam Haba,
you're saved.
Okay.
And the way for salvation is the giving, not the receiving of Torah. Or the Mizora of the Master.
Much more than that, but okay. We'll let that slide for
for some reason, shot.
For sake of brevity, okay? The highest wisdom decreed, however, that this world would be best attained if a man would first exist in the present world, bound by limits and its natural laws. This is actually the true and proper preparation necessary for the desired goal, and everything in this world was therefore arranged so that it should serve as a means of preparing and readying man for this ultimate purpose. Ultimate purpose is to enjoy God in the and His presence in the Olam Haba. This preparation involves two aspects, one concerning individuals and the other humanity as a whole. The preparation of the individual is his attainment of perfection through his deeds. Okay, understanding that what you're trying to do is take yourself to maturity. It's not that you're trying to earn, quote, your salvation. You're trying to reach a level of maturity and spirituality. The preparation of the individuals is to attain perfection through his deeds, and that the humanity as a whole involves the preparation of the entire human race for the world to come. Man was created with a good urge, Yetzer HaTov, and an evil urge, Yetzer HaTov, and free will. This then allows the human race to include some individuals who are good as well as others who are evil. Ultimately, the evil ones must be cast aside and the good ones gathered to form one perfected community. It is for this community that the future world and all that attained good are intended. So, now when you take what Luzzatto has said and you look at Romans 13, some things should begin to come clear for us, and some things with regards to some other issues should come to the forefront. Let every Gentile soul be subject to the governing authorities of the Jewish synagogue, for there is no legitimate authority except that of the Jewish Beit Din from God, and the authorities of the Beit Din that exist are appointed by God. This is a system that God established, and the Jewish people follow what is established. Now, one of the things that we will wrestle with as we go through the book of Romans, dealing with Hacham Shaul, is the great word law. The translators of the Septuagint, everybody knows the Septuagint, understands what the Septuagint is, right?
Yes. Not everybody, but I do.
The Septuagint was a translation of the Torah into Greek, the Hebrew into Greek.
And when was that done, your evidence?
Yeah, about 300 years before Yeshua, give or take. I wasn't there, so I'm not sure the exact date. But it's in the ballpark somewhere. If my memory is...
Yeah, it's sharpening.
Have to put it in the pencil sharpener every once in a while to get it straightened out. So this was made so that specifically in Alexandria and some places the Jews could, that were Greek-speaking Jews, could have a version of the Torah which they could read. Now, you must understand that when this translation was made, that the Greek-speaking Jews had vocabulary and jargon that they used that specifically suited how they interpreted the Torah. Okay, so that if they used particular phrases in Greek, those phrases were Hebraized phrases, or they contained Hebrew content, even though they may be in Greek language. Okay? So, the authors translate, and there's some tradition that goes around, Septuagint, and the reason it's called, if you see in some writings, it'll be Greek number 70, LXX. And when you see that, it's that there were 70 translators, and the idea was that the 70 translators were all put in individual rooms, and each was given their job of translating the Torah. And the miracle was that all of the translations were exactly the same. That's the myth. Okay, so we'll take it beyond that and say that the word nomos, or let's say it this way, the word Torah in a Hebrew Torah scroll, in the Torah itself, not the Tanakh, in the Torah, the word Torah appears about 220 times. The translators of the Septuagint, for 200 of the times that the word Torah appeared in the Torah, used the word nomos. Now, nomos is a very difficult word because it gives or lends itself more toward legal documents and things of that nature, and legalities, not legalism, legalities, and less toward the full meaning of the Torah, where we have guide, instruction, teachings, etc. Okay, so when it's used in the Septuagint, it is translated into the word nomos, and nomos, again, holding that idea of something that is law or legal. Now, when you begin to talk about nomos, or when you begin to talk about law, and so, for example, when you read in your texts, you'll receive the piece that you received this evening. To go with me to 17. No, excuse me, we're going to go to 12. 2:12. For as many have sinned without the Torah will also perish without the Torah. It's that they don't. It's not so much just that they didn't have the Torah. As you will see, they didn't. They have no excuse. And that's because Abraham was considered a living Torah. You'll see that in the text. Okay, so this is the first time in the book of Romans in 2 and 12 that the word nomos or law is used, or Torah is used. Okay, you have to do some very interesting hoops and studies when you look at the word nomos, because there are a multitude of ways that the word nomos can be translated, as is the same with Torah. Now, the first thing that you're going to hear Christianity say is that we're saved by grace and through faith and not by works, etc. Okay? So let's address this piece of the argument to begin with. Are we saved by grace or not?
The grace of God. Yes, but not exclusively.
Wasn't it by grace that the Torah was handed down at Mount Sinai?
Saved by grace through faithful obedience.
Okay. Jews, the Jewish people, say the matzah, the Torah, the giving of the Torah, is the grace of God. Okay? We received it by God's grace. Now, when we stop and think about salvation, and here we're back to we merit the Olam Haba or not, when it's all said and done, it's God's grace. Plain and simple. Okay? Now that doesn't, we're not addressing the idea of keeping or not keeping Torah, etc. But it's absolutely God's grace that that causes us to be able to enter into the Olam Haba. Now, it's going to be much more difficult than just saying, oh, I just accepted by grace that, you know, that's how it was going to be. And, you know, I figured I'd make it. Okay? That's, I don't think it's going to cut anything when he stands there and he says, you workers of iniquity. Now, when you read the word iniquity in Greek, it is a. Whenever you put, we know that this word now, nomos, is the Torah, right? So when we put an A on the front of a Greek word, it means no, not, without, against, etc. Okay? So here you have somebody with no Torah, that does not have the Torah, without the Torah, or who is against the Torah. Are you with me? So now when he says, depart from me, you workers of iniquity, what's he saying?
Depart from me.
You without the Torah.
You show me your Torah and I'll show you my grace. Okay? So if they don't have the Torah, or they're against the Torah, and surely we don't turn on the television and see anybody saying anything like that, right? Right?
I don't know what channel you get on.
I've never seen a single man do that. Never alone. There's always one or more.
Okay. Now, Christianity has this aversion for thinking that, you know, we have to in any way be Torah observant. I mean, it's for they're like, you know, God forbid that we should have to keep the Torah. And if you do keep the Torah, then that means that you're going back under the law and on and on and on and on. And they a million things that they'll say about Torah observance and us keeping any piece of the law. Should we keep the Sabbath? Should we be circumcised? Should we have prayer service on Sabbath, etc., etc.? You got all these things, and then everybody thinks everything is all about legalism. If you do keep Sabbath, if you are circumcised, if on and on and on, till the point that, you know, you'll get emails in your email accounts tell you how much salvation you need and how much prayer you need and all of these varying variables, and they don't have the first clue what they're talking about. Now let's stop and think about this for a minute. You take what it said here, Lozado said, that there's going to be a perfected community. Okay? And then you take Christianity today. And so, in the guise of rebellion against, quote, legalism, you have them saying, in essence, we don't want any Torah.
That all equals a nomos.
So if they say to you that they don't want the Torah, I'm going to show you that it's a direct affront to God Himself. And how can this possibly be? So God says, keep the Sabbath. God says, you know, do this. You know, and I'm not just talking about only 10 commandments. I'm talking about 613, those that are appropriate, etc. But the Christian looks at the Torah and he says, I don't want any part of it. All I want is, quote, Jesus, and then that's enough. And then, in the congregation, a Christian congregation, You've got two brothers, or so they call themselves brothers, that have an argument. And so one says to the other, you know, if you don't do what I want or it's theirs, then I'll take you to court. Okay? So as things escalate all of a sudden, they end up in court for whatever the infraction might be. So here's Christianity that says, we don't want the God to stick his fingers in telling us what to do in our lives. We're going to rely on men and not even an authentic Beit Din. We're just going to go to a court with some man set up there and let him make the decision. And then we're going to accept that decision. And that decision is going to be how we govern our lives. That is the most idiotic thing I've ever heard. When God has given a whole Torah and an oral Torah that deals with all of these situations, and they can go to the Beit Din, and the Beit Din's not just going to say, you're guilty and you're not guilty. The Beit Din's going to try to do something beyond that, some reconciliation between them, and not just hang this guy out to dry or whatever. So let's take a case law. Anoniel wants a garden in his backyard. And he says, Rabbi, he says, don't you have a tiller in your shed out back? And I said, I sure do. He said, can I use your tiller to till my garden? Why, certainly you can use my tiller to till your garden. So he comes, he loads up the tiller, and he heads home with the tiller. And on the way home, the tiller falls out of the back of the truck.
Was he speeding?
No, he just didn't tie it down and he hit a bump. It's Paris, right? Okay, so he comes back and he says, Rabbi, the tiller is no good. Look. So what'd you do to it? He said, well, it fell out of the truck, you know, and now it doesn't work. If you fix it, I'll use it on my garden. Is that the way it should go, or should it go some other way? Give it a root. Wait a second. Give it a root. What do you say?
I would say that he was responsible for it after he had left your home. Therefore, he has to replace it before he brings it back.
Interesting enough, that is Jewish law. Exactly what you said. Exactly what you said. Let's change the scenario now, okay? So when Yoel says, Yibra Rivka, we need a garden in the backyard. The rabbi's got a tiller. Said, maybe the rabbi would come over and till our garden for us. So, Adonuel comes. See, you know, anybody who sings happy birthday songs to his rabbi surely merits...
is that all it takes?
Oh, you got to hear the songs. We'll play the songs and I'll let you be the judge, okay? Oh,
come on now, you see, y'all don't know me like that.
So, I put the tiller in the back of my truck, and I get over to make it there, because I tie it down, because it's mine, I don't want it to. And so I get out, and I start tilling the garden, and man, there's more rocks in this place than, you know, you can imagine. You know, I look down, my poor tiller tines are getting bent and all that. And I say, Adonuel, you know, you're going to have to pay for this. These rocks are tearing up my tiller. So now the law says what?
Where's the contract?
Let me read that contract. Huh?
He would indeed be responsible because he didn't tell you that there's all those rocks in his ground. and had you been warned.
Now,
he didn't say he didn't know. If it's his land, he should know.
No, that's not necessarily true.
If he wanted to throw down a garden, he should have checked.
I believe that's his responsibility.
It's Don Young's responsibility.
Once his eminence found out that it was rocky, then he is the
one. The moment you start repairing, you can damage it beyond repair.
Okay.
He's the one operating it.
Okay, let me tell you Jewish halakha, okay? Jewish halakha makes it my responsibility. I stick that thing in the ground and all of a sudden start spitting out rocks and say, wait a minute here. You know, I'm smart enough to figure out not to ruin my tiller by just continuously trying to throw these rocks out. So it's my responsibility because he's basically contracted me, as it were, to do the job. Okay? So what you see here is a way of resolving difficulties between people in Judaism, rather than having to go down to, local judge, you know, who's got a caseload that looks like, you know, there's more criminals in Paris than there are. Don't answer that, Brother Randy.
I know.
So. Yeah, I thought it was funny too. Yeah, he's happy. He said we're on halakha. Okay. So you understand the situation now? Why would many Christians want to say that they don't want the law of God to govern them, and that they want some heathen out here? Who, you don't know what, you don't know if he cares the first thing. You don't even know if the guy is not high or whatever and sitting in the seat.
Interestingly enough.
Hush, we didn't ask you.
That's good.
This may not be the answer you're looking for, but it's kind of an oxymoron. It's almost like they like the idea of what a Messiah stands for and they want to follow, but they don't want to do anything else. But then they're not following because they're not doing. So it's an oxymoron.
Yeah, so in essence, what it boils down to is an anti-nomane anarchist mentality. You know, we don't want the Torah. We don't want to live life by this this thing. We don't want to be judged by... we don't want to be judged by some standard, etc. But let's read it again one time and come to an understanding here. The highest wisdom decreed, however, that this world would be best attained if man would first exist in the present world, bound and limited by its laws. Now, one thing you need to come to an awareness of is that when we talk about laws, and when you talk about how that the entire universe is being governed, you understand that God has established and set in motion governing authorities. The governing authorities we call malakim, or we call angels. Okay, the angels, whenever you hear everybody in the world say, you know, I got a guardian angel, and he kept me from having an accident, or he did this, or he did that. Well, let me tell you something. If he did keep you from having an accident, that meant that God's not done with you yet. Okay? That has nothing to do with you being so special that he said, you know what? I got to look out for this guy because he's so special, you know, the world can't run without him. That's the way they see it. You talk to people about all those things and that's exactly the way they think it is. But listen, the word shomer in Hebrew means to guard, but we use it in the sense of like shomer Shabbat. And when you use the phrase shomer Shabbat, what we're trying to say is that this person is meticulous about keeping Shabbat. So if he's meticulous about keeping it, he's guarding it to make sure that he doesn't violate it in any way. So what do you think this angel's doing?
Shomer Ra.
He's trying to show you, and by the way, he's the same one that instructed you while you were in your mother's womb for 9 months and teaching you the Torah, right? And so what he does as he wants to make sure you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And he's constantly whispering in your ear saying, you need to do this, you need to do that, or you don't need to be doing that. He's not there at 100% as a protection just to pat you on the back to make sure you're doing okay. That's not his job. His job is that what he wants to do is see to it that you are keeping the Torah. And by the way, he said the same guy's going to be the one when you stand and are judged. And he's going to say, what did you do with the Torah that I taught you? Remember what I taught you? And then you say, well, he's going to say, no. I told you.
I did what you said. What are you talking about?
Okay, now listen. So the laws, and this is actually the true and proper preparation necessary for the desired goal, and everything in the world was therefore arranged so that it should serve as a means for preparing and readying man for this ultimate purpose. This preparation involves two aspects, one concerning the individuals and the other humanity as a whole. The preparation of the individual is his attainment of perfection through deeds, again, maturity through his activities. That of humanity as a whole involves preparation of the entire human race for the world to come. Man was created with the good urge, a Yetzer HaTov, and an evil urge, the Yetzer Hara, and free will. This then allows the human race to include some individuals who are good as well as others who are evil. Now that sounds like an oxymoron, right? Why couldn't God just have created a world of nothing but good? No resistance. If there's no resistance, there's no way to I worked in horticulture quite a bit in California, and we put trees inside of buildings, and they never do well inside of buildings. Not like it takes a considerable amount of effort and labor to take care of them. You know why they don't stabilize inside of a building?
They don't have the adversity that they would have in natural conditions outside.
Yeah, the wind's not blowing, strengthen their roots, etc., etc. Okay, so this allows for some individuals to be good and others who are evil. Ultimately, the evil ones must be cast aside and the good ones gathered from one perfected community. Now, just a quick question. You know, what do you think is going to be the governing law when we reach the days of Messiah?
The Torah. Plain and simple.
Keeping the Sabbath. And make deeds will make the judgments.
So,
although some things will be changed.
Oh, absolutely. I don't question the thought of there being change. I hope there's a whole lot of change. But the point is simple enough that, you know what, you can be training for the Olam Haba by studying Torah now, right? Because there's going to be one rule that governs the rule during the Yomot HaMashiach, the days of Messiah, and that will be the Torah. And Messiah will be the king who sits upon the throne, and he will demand rule to be according to the Torah. So now, what do you think's going to happen when some of these people say to Yeshua, no, we're saved by faith, man?
He's going to say faith in what?
If it wasn't faithful obedience to God.
They'll be taking Torah 101.
I knew a guy that said that in Assembly of God Church and got kicked out.
Well, this ain't Assembly of God.
But in essence, that's what he said. He did not say Torah, but he told him, he said, what do you think we're going to be doing for 1,000 years, you know, as we prepare for the Olam Haba? He didn't use Olam Haba.
I think what is so astounding, though, is when you stop and you think about it, the 613 commandments that you refer to all the time in the Torah, to where the churches, your modern-day churches, teach that you have to adhere to the laws of the land in order to be righteous. But yet we refer to the people that we elect that go up in there to legislature as lawmakers.
Yeah. You do know that in the very beginning of our country, we considered adopting the 613 as the legal code.
Yeah.
And it was considered at that time to make the language of the New World, United States, or the American Americas, as it is now, Hebrew. These were considerations. And it was amazing. Chaim Solomon designed the seal for the $1 bill, Jewish Kabbalist. And when he came up with the saying in the $1 bill says, E pluribus unum means?
Out of many one.
Huh?
Out of many one.
One nation under God is its intent. Okay? That's not what he said.
It doesn't mean we're taking over?
No. It's not what he said. He didn't say that.
We already took over. You just
he said, one nation under one God. That was his intent. And what did they do? No, it's too Jewish. It's too Jewish. We got to have a Trinity. And so we'll say, we just drop one and it's okay. We don't have to worry about this. Okay, so in the beginning of our foundation, our forefathers did consider these things. But now it's come to the place here where, as Randy is saying and others are saying that, you know, we throw off the yoke of God, as it were, so that we can accept
the yoke of man.
And then this is good Christianity.
It's that pride thing.
And fail to realize that, you know, if you could look at the way that the biblical society, if you could really imagine how the biblical societies functioned and how they kept their observance, it would be astounding. And what I think in the end is going to be is one or two things. I will refer to Gaston and Paul of the Torah, who says, in the end, the Gentiles will have one of two options. They'll basically convert to Judaism, or they'll camp out and roast marshmallows, I guess. Whatever it is you do down there with that.
So where it says the big picture, the phrase that says who exchanged the truth of God for a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where we're at?
Well, you know, but Rabbi, not to defend them, they're only being midrashic in the end.
Say again.
They're only being midrashic in the end. They just don't know it. Right? Because the midrash says he went to one nation. I don't want you to do this. Oh, no. We absolutely love to do that, so we wouldn't dare. It's like somehow, if you can mix some mysticism, it's almost like the angel touched them and they forgot.
Yeah. Well, the angel did touch them and they did forgot, but they just don't want to. See, I always say that as did Rabbi Akiva Tatz, he said, you never learn truth. You know it. You know, if somebody says something and it's true, it resonates with inside yourself. You know it's true. It doesn't have
to. Have to be convinced.
Yeah, somebody doesn't have to give some long theological argument to make you believe that this is the truth. You know it's true. And, you know, what does it take to resist the authority of God? And, you know, the difficulty is I'm going to say that it's an absolute ignorance, but there's a tremendous amount of anarchy in the process.
There's a difference between defying his authority and challenging his finality. Because Moshe challenged him, so a few others.
Questions or comments before we close? So tell all your Christian friends.
I believe you're supposed to play a birthday song here, but...
No, I'll have to do that later. You want me to play you a birthday song? Or you want me to get the kids?
I want everyone online to hear your birthday song.
Here we're at Ruth.
Is there a difference if someone knows and goes against the Torah and someone who doesn't know the right way and goes against the Torah unknowingly?
Well, it's very interesting because Paul, in the readings that you will have for this evening, starting tomorrow evening, he makes that argument. And he says, and he shows, he will very soon pick up Abraham. We picked up Abraham before he did. Because we know he's going to pick up Abraham. But it's very interesting. Abraham has no law, but he's called the living Torah, the living Nomos. And he had no one to tell him Torah to begin with. He deduced Torah.
From a burning man.
And then, did he complete yeshiva?
Afterward.
That's your homework to find out if Abraham completed yeshiva or not. And you have to give me chapter and verse.
A bear chiva.
A bear chiva? Give her a Hadassah. Is that what kind of shiva is that?
That is the Shiva Shiva.
Yeah. So. That was his vacation retirement home. He turned it over to Isaac at that point. He moved to Beersheba.
I like the Bear Lechoroy myself. Give her a Hadassah. She has a remark
for
course.
So the read the passage from when he's telling his students that he'll be handed over to the Gentiles and the lost and is treated and spit on. Does that correlate to the Torah portion? Because we are still talking about the princes, the heads of the tribes who were beaten while they were in Egypt and mistreated while they were in Egypt.
What I did, he's looking at that passage and he's speaking of it. If you look at, let's see. If you look in chapter 15 of Mark, of course, there's a play on words starting 7, verse 7, Barabbas, right, means that it should be like the son of the father. It's a play on words. And then you come and you see that they hand him over to Pilate. Okay, so, you know, who hands him over to Pilate? It's the chiefs. Chiefs, priests, etc. But obviously, you understand that this is it is a kangaroo court. But what it is a defunct priesthood, right? They've already come to the place that they've sold out for the sake of the almighty dollar or whatever.
It's a bought-off priesthood.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting though that, you know, Pilate knows that he's absolutely innocent, right? So why doesn't he just turn him loose instead of trying to placate these people?
Because they have money.
So that means what? That he gets some?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have to play that game. He could play that game, but and I don't think that he played the game of some monetary game in this case. I think he really did struggle within himself whether he should do this or not. And I think in some respects he tried not to, but yeah, the problem was that they had the power to go over his head.
Is that why he washed his hands?
That's why he
thrashed
police.
Is that what falls in the van?
Yes, he declares his innocence, right? And this is what you have to do with the Pesach sacrifice, right? You have to declare that it's pure and holy, and that's what he did. He came and he came into Jerusalem on the 10th of Nisan. When do you select the lamb? You hold it for 4 days, etc. Okay. Questions or comments, others?
Well, can we see maybe a comparison, a thematic comparison, both in positive ways from the Torah, but negative?
Yeah. The antithesis.
We have the chiefs bringing their gifts and then bringing to Moshe, who is ahead of everything, prototype of Moshiach.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have Yeshua, Mashiach, and the chiefs, but they are illegitimate chiefs.
Right.
Who are corrupt in their gifts at this Pesach are corrupt.
Right, absolutely.